Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're discussing the life, work and legacy of someone who has been called the prophet of democracy or even the sphinx of democracy, a French writer who some say wrote the best book ever about the United States, Alexis de Tocqueville. We'd love you to join our discussion. You can text the show at 53106 and text costs 30 cents, or you can email us at talkinghistory@newstalk.com. Last week we looked at medieval Irish pilgrimages to Santiago de Compostela and the real story of the woman who inspired one of the world's best-loved operas, La Traviata, in our monthly book show. And 2 weeks ago we were live in Kilkenny in the wonderful surroundings of the Seth Theatre in the Langton House Hotel, where we debated the history of Kilkenny with a wonderful panel of experts. And again, if you want to listen back to any of those shows, just go to our website newstalk.com or go directly to iTunes. Born in France into an old aristocratic family on the 29th of July, 1805, Alexis de Tocqueville visited the United States in 1831 with his friend Gustave de Beaumont. His book, based on his travels, Democracy in America, published in 2 volumes, became an instant classic and is still widely quoted for its insights into American politics, society, and the concept of liberty. It has been said that no one has ever described American democracy with more accurate insight or more profoundly than Alexis de Tocqueville. Tocqueville visited Ireland in 1835, again with Beaumont, and examined the conditions of tenants. They also travelled around England and Algeria. Involved in politics back home in France, Tocqueville sat in Parliament and briefly served as Foreign Minister in 1849. Tocqueville died of tuberculosis on the 16th of April, 1859. In his biography of Tocqueville, Harvey Mansfield has written that Tocqueville lived through the coming of democracy to France and foresaw that it would eventually spread to the whole world. Tocqueville has been called many things: a writer, an historian, a social scientist, a political theorist, and a new kind of liberal. So in tonight's show, we want to look at his life, his work, and his legacy. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Professor Robert Gilday is Professor of Modern History at the University of Oxford and is an expert on French and European history in the 19th and 20th centuries. And his most recent book is Empires of the Mind: On the Colonial Past and the Politics of the Present. Professor Andreas Hess teaches in the School of Sociology at UCD and is an expert on American social and political thought. His books include Tocqueville and Beaumont, Aristocratic Liberalism in Democratic Times, and he is an acclaimed expert on the work of Tocqueville and Beaumont. Dr. Kevin Butterfield is Executive Director of the Fred W. Smith National Library for the Study of George Washington at Mount Vernon. An historian of the political and legal culture of the early American Republic, he is the author of The Making of Tocqueville's America, Law and Association in the Early United States. And joining us for the first part of the show, I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Chris W. Serprenant, the Director of the Alexis de Tocqueville Project on Law, Liberty and Morality at the University of New Orleans. He's an expert on the history of moral and political philosophy and the author of Kant and the Cultivation of Virtue. Well, you're all very welcome. And later in the show, I'll be talking to Professor Harvey Mansfield, Professor of Government at Harvard University and the author of Tocqueville, A Very Short Introduction, Professor Jeremy Jennings, the head of the School of Politics and Economics at King's College London and the co-editor of Tocqueville on America After 1840, and Professor Albert Zur, who teaches at Bowling Green State University in Ohio and who has written on democratic professionalism. Well, as I say, you are all very welcome. And Robert, I'd love to start with you and maybe the question of why should we be doing a full show on Alexis de Tocqueville? Why is he someone who still matters today in the 21st century?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, you called him the prophet of democracy and also the sphinx of democracy. He was a man who saw that democracy was here to stay after the French Revolution. But he also had very great concerns about the dangers of democracy. He talked about the danger of tyranny of majority. He talked about the dangers of a dictator or a despot who could be based on the popular will. He was very concerned that democracy meant that you didn't always get the best politicians to elected or to volunteer to serve. And I suppose in a word, he was a man who talked about the dangers of democracy. And I think if he came back and looked at the sort of populism that we see in the modern world at the moment, he would be, on the one hand, shocked, but he would also sit down and write several leaders in the paper about how we could find a way forward.
Andreas, it's very interesting that we're still reading Tocqueville today, and you see him still quoted widely.
Yes, and not always correctly, I have to say. He's both the prophet and the Sphinx. He does both. He looks at the pros and the cons of democracy and breaks it down nicely for the reader. So he's one of the few successful men who managed to combine political life with political theory or political thought, a combination that isn't always that great.
Very good. Kevin, it's interesting what Andrea said there about how he's not always quoted correctly. There's a quote that Tocqueville never said that keeps popping up in the United States, the quote that the line that America is great because she is good, and if America ever ceases to be good, America will cease to be great. Everyone from Ronald Reagan to Bill and Hillary Clinton have used it and attributing it to Tocqueville without it ever actually having been written by him. It's part, though, of the allure of Tocqueville that his name bestows a credibility on these kinds of insights.
That's exactly right. And I'm always struck by the ways in which people on both sides of a conservative-liberal divide find things in Tocqueville that really speak to them, that allow them to make a case for a particular way of moving forward in our democracy. The conservatives look to his emphasis on private association and a vibrant civil society and people solving problems for themselves rather than leaning upon the government. And liberals look to the way that he described the problems of wealth inequality in the society, or look to his emphasis on the liberty of the press. That people are always able to find things in Tocqueville, even without making things up. They're always able to find things to argue for their position.
Chris, could you make the case that people are responding still to his ideas today? Is that happening?
Of course they are, and you see this in what Kevin says. When we talk with our students and other people about Tocqueville, one of the things I like to say is that he provides us with a type of political Rorschach test, right? You can look at Democracy in America or other Tocqueville's writings, and what people pull out or what people gravitate to, especially when talking about contemporary politics, often gives you an insight of their own views and what they think is correct themselves. And they use Tocqueville like anyone uses one of the greats in the history of philosophy or Western thought to provide some oomph behind the views that they want to advance.
Andreas, I wonder, and I feel a little bit guilty about this, I wonder, should we be calling the show Tocqueville and Beaumont? Because they had such a close relationship and they were so much involved in these works. And Beaumont was there with him in the United States, in Ireland, in England and in Algeria. That I wonder, is it unfair that Beaumont always seems to be neglected in these kinds of discussions?
Yeah, although Beaumont would be the last person who would have an issue with that. He in a letter more than once, or in letters more than once, he actually confessed or admired Tocqueville. At the same time, it's a little bit unfair to mention him at all. You can assume that every paragraph, every sentence that was ever written by the two was read by mutually by each other. They edited each other's texts and made recommendations. So the letters between them show that in great detail. And then the other thing that I would like to add is that they complement each other in a nice way. So if Tocqueville has the kind of cinemascopic view on things, while Beaumont looks a little bit deeper, he's almost more concrete. He looks at the peculiarities and he looks at those who are left behind in the democratic process.
Robert, can we try and situate Tocqueville within his context? Because it's very interesting that he's born in 1805, but very much in that shadow of the French Revolution and everything that was happening, Napoleon coming to power. And he was a man who was, I suppose, part of that old Ancien Régime world, but also coming to terms with the new reality. And the fact that he was from an aristocratic family gave him another insight into it as well.
Well, absolutely. I mean, he, as you say, he was born into an aristocratic family. Allegedly, he could trace his ancestors back to William the Conqueror, but he was born into this maelstrom, which was the sort of generation between the French Revolution of 1789 and the fall of Napoleon in 1815. He was born plumb in that period of war, civil war, revolution. And the world that he knew, or the world that his family knew, which was the a world dominated by the monarchy, the aristocracy, the Catholic Church, all that was swept away by the French Revolution. And in fact, his father and mother narrowly escaped being guillotined during the French Revolution. Most of his mother's family were executed or during this revolution. So you might expect that he would be a guy who just wanted to turn the clock back and put his head under the pillow and so on. But he was a very thoughtful what we would now call a social scientist, and he saw that democracy was here to stay, and that the great challenge of the 19th century was how to work out how in a sense one could get the best out of democracy. And I think what his basic message was, the French Revolution, and indeed Napoleon, when he was in power, concentrated above all on equality, but equality was very dangerous in many ways, and therefore what the French had lost sight of was liberty, that they preferred equality to liberty, and liberty was under threat. And so I think he went to the United States in order to he sort of saw it as a kind of laboratory where democracy was already in action and flourishing. He saw that this democracy would come to Europe, and so he was going to see how it worked before it finally did get to Europe.
Andreas, you wanted to get in there?
Yeah, if I just can come in on this one. I mean, it's amazing that when we talk about the French Revolution, it's not something that many people considered to be finished in the 19th century. It goes on and on and on. Problems remain. They are partly solved or then partly not addressed. And that worries Tocqueville. He thinks this country, France, needs stability. And that's exactly what it didn't get. It got various regimes. It takes a long time before the French actually sort out their problems in the course of the 19th century. And Tocqueville and Beaumont are witnesses to that.
Chris, can you tell us about the Tocqueville project that you're involved in? Because it seems that it's directly using his work to try and deal with and consider some of these questions that he was wrestling with back in the 19th century.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that we're trying to do in New Orleans and at the University of New Orleans is to show how these ideas that we've seen since Tocqueville, but even before Tocqueville, are still relevant to what we're doing today. And so, as you may know, and the listeners know, Tocqueville visited New Orleans when he was in the United States. And one of the things he did was he came down and looked at our prison in New Orleans. And one of his observations about the prison in New Orleans was that it seems like the prisoners in New Orleans were treated worse than animals. And this is an issue that we're having right now in the United States when it comes to mass incarceration, when it comes to issues of refugees, and to think that, you know, these are not new problems. These are problems that have been recurring for a while. And so we see with someone like Tocqueville that not only has he observed similar problems that have happened in the United States, but perhaps by thinking about, you know, his observations, we can perhaps think about a better path forward or think about maybe some of the problems that those various paths forward lead to. And so that's one of the things we're trying to do in New Orleans with our students, is to understand that these problems, as much as people like to think that we're in this new time, right, that there are all these crazy things happening in the United States and elsewhere, it's really not all that different from how things have happened before. It's just that you need perhaps a different perspective, and often Tocqueville can help provide that.
And Kevin, it is extraordinary how that trip to the United States became the basis then of this two-volume masterpiece. And he got some things right, he got some things wrong, but the insights were on his reflections on liberty, on equality, on participation, on what it meant to be a democracy and a functioning republic, and his interest in elections. It was something that became this classic and became this huge bestseller.
And I think it's because he came here to my side of the Atlantic in order to study democracy, not necessarily to study America. He saw America as someone has already mentioned as a place in which to study this thing that he knew was going to be coming to the rest of the world. And as he studies democracy in America and sees a remarkable resilience and stability in the American context that he didn't see elsewhere. And he was trying to put his finger on what was making it work here and trying to understand the physical circumstances, the laws, but ultimately really the culture, the mores of the people, so that he could understand their customs, their attitudes, their ways of life. That's where he really began to understand how American democracy seemed to be stable and functioning. Despite all the anxieties that he has about the future, he sees here something worth studying and something that he wants to share with France.
And he also got to meet the president, Andrew Jackson.
He met so many people. It is remarkable that Beaumont and Tocqueville had great encounters. He was both men were unimpressed with Andrew Jackson, who was president during their 9 months of visiting the United States, and ultimately saw him as a good example of an unworthy man at head of state, a man who was famous simply because he'd won a battle 20 years earlier at the Battle of New Orleans, actually. But they also had opportunities to meet people who were already famous and important. Daniel Webster comes to mind, and men like Sam Houston, who would make his mark on history somewhat later. They stumbled across him in their travels. Their encounters and their conversations were remarkable, and it's unlike, say, Aristotle. We have the papers, we have the notes, we have the diaries and the scrapbooks that Tocqueville kept. So we're able to sort of trace his thinking as he encounters people, has different conversations and different experiences.
Andreas, that is very interesting in terms of the meeting, impressed with some, not with others.
Yeah, particularly this encounter with Andrew Jackson. I mean, if you think about that, Andrew Jackson is one of those heroes of Donald Trump today. So that might be tell the story.
That does indeed tell a story. Robert, you teased out some of the ideas when you mentioned his thoughts on the tyranny of the majority. Talk to us about some of these concepts and some of these ideas that he was wrestling with.
Well, I think the tyranny of the majority idea was that the idea that in a democracy the majority takes all, as it were. You have a government, you have a party with a majority. And in a sense, it can dictate to the minority. And he, like other liberals in the 19th century, such as John Stuart Mill, were worried that this kind of mass, this majority, which was based on universal suffrage, not usually not including women, but universal suffrage, or as near as damn it, would mean that, if you like, people like himself, the educated, the sensitive, the aristocratic, would be bulldozed out of the way. But also he was concerned that minorities, be they social minorities or religious minorities or ethnic minorities, might find themselves permanently in a minority. So rather than, you know, democracy works okay if there's a kind of ding-dong left and right, Republican, Democrat, or Labour and Tory. But if one side, you know, if there's a case that the winner takes all, then I think he was concerned that those minorities, their voices and their interests would not be heard, and I think that was one of his main concerns.
Chris, it's interesting as well to see read his thoughts on whether virtue needed to be a guiding force, because he saw in America that what was working was a concept of self-interest and a desire to make money.
Yeah, of course, and it's interesting that Andres brought up Trump. I mean, when you look at, say, the making money and Trump, and one of the things that, you know, has stuck when people are criticizing Trump is that, you know, he inherited this fortune, he is all about making money, but, you know, what he did with it wasn't great. I mean, there's this issue in Tocqueville about this leveling effect of American democracy, and that's one of the things when Kevin mentions the people that they stumbled across in the United States and how they were able to encounter all of these important people, that's one of the interesting impacts of democracy, and it's interesting to see perhaps how that has changed. But this leveling impact and this leveling effect, I think, can be seen, you know, in the United States right now. And again, you know, when you look at the criticisms of Trump that have sort of stuck in the popular, you know, press, right? Not just sort of the intellectual criticisms of Trump, but the money one is one of them. And that's something that I think you can see that Tocqueville has talked about, and it's one of the things that people sort of don't like. And he was really tuned into that.
Very good. Well, we're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we're going to be talking to Professor Jeremy Jennings, and we're also going down here from Professor Harvey Mansfield. So stay with us here on News Talk.
Talking history. This is News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we debate the life, work and legacy of Alexis de Tocqueville. I'm delighted to be joined now by Professor Jeremy Jennings. He's head of the School of Politics and Economics and Professor of Political Theory at King's College London. An expert on the history of political thought in France, he's the co-editor of Tocqueville on America After 1840, Letters and Other Writings, and he's currently finishing a book provisionally entitled Travels with Tocqueville. Jeremy, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
I'm very pleased to be with you. Thank you very much.
Could we begin, I suppose, with the idea of Tocqueville as a traveller, because he seems to have had an extraordinary curiosity for the world.
That's right. Well, he famously went to America in the early 1830s and wrote his book on democracy in America. But in actual fact, he travelled lots of other countries in the 1820s. He travelled around Italy and Sicily and so on. But then later on, he travelled to Britain, he travelled to Ireland, he travelled to Switzerland, and he travelled several times to Algeria. And he thought that travel was a very useful way of getting to know about a subject. At one point he says he doesn't agree with the people who think you can write about a subject or write about a country without ever being there. And he thought you have to go to a place, you have to talk to people, you have to see it, you have to investigate what was going on, and then draw your conclusions from it. So travel for him was a very important methodological tool which he had.
And he had travelled extensively by the time he had come to Ireland.
That's right. Well, his trip to America was 1831, 1832, and then he came back to France and started to write what was to be the first volume of Democracy in America, came out in 1835. In 1833, he came his first trip to England, and he didn't really see much upon that occasion. He largely stayed in the south of England, and he went to visit some of the great English aristocratic families. But then in 1835, he came back to Britain with his close friend Gustave de Beaumont, and they were inveterate travellers together. And for reasons which are not entirely clear, on that second visit where they went to Birmingham and they went to Manchester to see, you know, the beginnings of industrialization, for some reason, they decide to come to Ireland. And that's what they do after they've been to Birmingham and Manchester. And they spend about 6 weeks together in Ireland, traveling around Ireland in a fairly conventional way, the way tourists still do to this day, arriving in Dublin and then heading south down to Waterford and then going round to Cork and then going up the west to Galway and so on. And then, again, crossing back across the middle as people often do.
And it's interesting, as you say, we know where he travelled.
Yes.
We know the people he met, and it seems like he spoke to an extraordinary number of people.
He always did. I mean, this was his basic technique, was to really, wherever he went, to throw himself into it and talk to anyone, high and low. It didn't really matter who they were. He always felt you could learn something from the people in the street, or the people in this case at Trinity College Dublin, or from Catholic bishops and wherever it might be. And he always took very extensive notes, and he would take notes of the actual conversations. He would take notes about the places he's visited, the things he'd seen, and then along the way would write these little sort of commentaries drawing his conclusions of what he was seeing along the way. So we can be quite precise. We know he went to Kilkenny and so on and so forth, and we know when in Kilkenny who he met, etc.
Given that he left so many notes and he made so many notes,
yes,
how come he didn't then go home and produce a great work, Democracy in Ireland, or some other title?
That's a very good question, and again, we can only really sort of begin to sort of guess at the answer to that. The clue, or two clues really. Clue number one is that he'd still needed to finish his book on America. So the first volume comes out in 1835, and the second volume comes out in 1840. So he's still got a lot of stuff to be done about America. That's the first side of it. The second thing is he travels with Gustave de Beaumont. When they went to America, they did a similar thing there. They divided up their labors. Tocqueville said, I'll write the book on the politics, and you can write about other things, which he did. Beaumont wrote a famous novel called Marie, which is about slavery. And it's quite clear that in Ireland, when they came to Ireland, they decided that Tocqueville was busy with America, and it would be his friend, Gustave de Beaumont, who would write the book on Ireland, which he did, of course, which was one of the most famous books in Ireland in the 19th century.
Did Tocqueville's views of Ireland change once he arrived here? Did it affect how he viewed Britain and British politics? And did it change how he viewed maybe the principles of democracy itself?
I don't think it changed the way he saw Ireland, because I don't really think he knew much about Ireland. Incidentally, one of the things we do know is that his eldest brother visited Ireland in the late 1820s. We know that. So he'd have been familiar with something about Ireland from his brother. So his brother would have told him something about Ireland. But he doesn't really have, I think, a fixed view on Ireland. Now, he comes to Ireland, he takes a boat from Liverpool, he arrives in Dublin. Within two days, he basically says something like, if you want to see what a conquering country with a powerful aristocracy and a foreign church can do to a country, then come to Ireland. He's got that very, very, very quickly. And then when he subsequently travels around Ireland, that view is confirmed, that there's a tyranny of the English government, the awfulness of the aristocracy, and this imposed, externally imposed Protestant church, which is essentially living off the people of Ireland. So that's the image he gets in Ireland very quickly. What then happens is, of course, it then has to feed that back into his vision of England, and that's essentially what changes. Because what he realizes, and there's this beautiful sketch when he says, let's imagine two aristocracies. Let's imagine effectively a good aristocracy which supports the people and all those sorts of things. And he says, that's what you get in England. Let's imagine a bad aristocracy which exploits the people, etc., etc., etc. That's what you've got in Ireland. And then he says, but they're the same people. The same people, the same aristocracy which is favored in England, is the very aristocracy which is exploiting Ireland and the Irish people. And that's the problem then he has to try and grapple with. Now, the other thing to mention is that from his trips to America, Tocqueville concludes that the path towards democracy is unstoppable. Okay, it will happen. It is inevitable. It's providential. So he comes to England and he comes to Ireland and he has to say, well, how, if this is the case, how do England and Ireland fit into that model which I've got about democratization? Answer is, in the Irish case, he sees a country aspiring to democracy. In the English case, he sees a country aspiring to prevent that democracy taking place. But he thinks that one of the things which will bring democracy to England is essentially Ireland, because he realizes, in the way that a lot of other people have realized, that there is this tragic joint destiny of these two countries. That England will be constantly haunted by Ireland, and Ireland will sit on England's shoulder all the time, nagging away at it until such time as it realizes that this aristocratic society they have can no longer endure. So it changes the way he sees England more than the way it changes the way he sees Ireland.
Oh, very interesting indeed. Well, my thanks, Professor Jeremy Jennings, for joining me tonight, Head of the School of Politics and Economics and Professor of Political Theory at King's College London. Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. Thanks very much indeed. Bye-bye.
We'll be back with more on Alexis de Tocqueville right after this break.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we debate the life, the work and the legacy of Alexis de Tocqueville. I'm delighted to be joined now by Professor Harvey Mansfield, Professor of Government at Harvard University, where he has taught since 1962. An expert on political philosophy, he's the author of Tocqueville, A Very Short Introduction, published by Oxford University Press. And together with his wife, Delba Winthrop, he translated and co-authored an edition of Tocqueville's Democracy in America. Harvey, you're very welcome to the show.
How good of you to have me.
Can we begin by trying to pin down Tocqueville's political philosophy? How can we describe him, or how should we describe him? Was he a liberal conservative, or what was he?
He's very difficult to pin down in that way. One might start from the formula, he was a liberal aristocrat, because he looked at modern liberalism in a way that, or from a viewpoint that we don't have today. He comes just after the French Revolution. His father was imprisoned, scheduled for guillotining, and escaped by the skin of his teeth. And so he was always aware of the contrast between democracy and aristocracy, and in a way that we no longer are. And so he conveys the weaknesses of democracy and also its strengths with an alternative in mind. Today, there doesn't seem to be any viable alternative to democracy or liberal democracy, and so we treat it as a given. For him, it's historically a given. It's both historically and providentially fated to be a democratic era in which we live now, but it isn't perfect, and it isn't the only way in which human beings can be governed.
And is that what drew him to visit the United States? He wanted to see this democracy in action.
That's right. He came here for 9 months in 1831 to 32, traveled throughout the country, started from New York and went up to what was then the frontier in the Midwest, Michigan and Wisconsin, then spent a couple of weeks in Quebec because he wanted to see how his countrymen, the French, were doing in the New World, and then back down to Boston, out west to Cincinnati, down the Mississippi, to New Orleans, and up through the American South, again to New York. And so it took him 9 months, saw a lot of Americans, and spoke to some of the most prominent ones, like Andrew Jackson, Albert Gallatin, Roger Taney, Daniel Webster. See, these were famous American politicians of that era. But and he was with his friend Gustave de Beaumont, the two of them, very young, 1831, that's 26 years old. He was born in 1805. So, his English improved as he went along. So yes, he prepared himself by coming to America. Then he went back to France, had a graduate student or two help him with the footnotes and research for his book, which the first volume of which was published in 1835.
And it's interesting, it's a book that's a classic. It's still read by students and scholars, and it still has all these extraordinary insights into the America of the 19th century. And he writes about that the passion for elections, the same way Europeans might have it for bullfighting in Spain or the theater. And it's an extraordinary insight into the America of that time.
It is. He's very well known for his predictions, most of which have come true, and just for his analysis of the permanent features of democracy. So the book is called Democracy in America. So it's about democracy in a kind of theoretical way, which can be everywhere, but it's also about the particular features of America in which democracy was found. And see, when he came to America, it was not in an aristocratic spirit of hauteur, looking down on Americans because they merely represented European civilization in an uncivilized part of the world, which was a more usual way of looking at America. But he thought that America was actually ahead of Europe. And that was because it was democratic. Europe is heading towards democracy, but it isn't there yet. And so America will tell Europe what's going to happen.
You mentioned predictions. What did he predict? What did he get right?
The conflict between the races. There he didn't get it quite right. He thought that there might be a civil war between blacks and whites. And the possibility that there might be a civil war between the whites over the fate of the blacks didn't occur to him. And that may have been because he wasn't aware of Abraham Lincoln. He died, Tocqueville died in 1859, and Lincoln became president in 1860. So he didn't foresee the exact outcome there, but he understood the qualities of the three races.
Do you think he would make of America's fractured political landscape today?
The polarization that we see. He spoke of two kinds of parties in America. Great parties, which are great issues, like the Federalists versus the Democratic Republicans in the early days of the American Republic, about 1800, versus the later development of political parties, small parties, just concerned with questions of ambition and career with nothing much at stake. And what is strange about American politics now is that we act as if it were great issues that were dividing us, but they aren't so great. And so people are all impassioned with not so much at stake as a revolutionary outlook might suggest. It's more that we're tired of ourselves and angry. So you can't apply his reasoning exactly to everything that you see today. You can understand it better.
Okay, well, Harvey, thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Professor Harvey Mansfield, Professor of Government at Harvard University, author of Tocqueville, A Very Short Introduction, and many other leading works. And thank you so much, Harvey, for joining us.
Thank you and goodbye.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History. This is News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we debate the life, work and legacy of Alexis de Tocqueville. I'm joined by Professor Robert Gilday, Professor of Modern History at the University of Oxford, Professor Andreas Hess of the School of Sociology at UCD, Dr. Kevin Butterfield, Executive Director of the Fred W. Smith National Library for the Study of George Washington at Mount Vernon, and for this final part of the show, joined by Professor Albert Zur, who teaches at Bowling Green State University in Ohio, and whose books include Democratic Professional. Andreas, can we talk about his role as a politician and statesman? Because usually when someone is a political theorist and also actively involved in politics, they tend to be better at one than the other. How was he as a politician?
Well, he had a good record, though it didn't last very long. And we have to talk about the various stages and the ways he got involved. So at one point he was part of the French Assembly. And then I think the lucky or the happiest part, if you want, of his political career is actually after 1848. There's another revolution in France, and he becomes part of the new Assembly and there deliberates about the new constitution that they're going to come up with. Of course, it's all going to Potsdam within a short period of time. And when Louis Napoleon, takes over, then things really fall apart. Both Beaumont and Tocqueville are getting arrested, and it's the end of their political career. But during that half year, and then the year before when he was foreign minister, and Beaumont, his friend, was then ambassador in London first and then in Vienna, that's a fascinating part of their political career.
And Robert, it's very interesting to get that insight into his thoughts on democracy in France at that period.
Yes, I mean, as Andreas said, he gets involved. He famously, when universal suffrage is introduced into France in 1848, he famously takes his peasants who've now got the vote to vote, and they vote for him, and he becomes a politician, and as Andrea said, he gets involved in the elaboration of a new constitution. And interestingly, he's in favor of the election of a president of the republic by universal suffrage on the American model. But then, as Andrea said, Louis Napoleon, who's the nephew of the great Napoleon, is elected, and within a very short period of time, turns against the assembly that has elected him, and dissolves it, and sets up an authoritarian constitution, and becomes what Tocqueville called a democratic despot. That's to say, a despot who enjoys the support of the people, because the constitution was voted by a plebiscite, and Napoleon actually cunningly reintroduces universal suffrage, which had been momentarily blocked. So, in fact, Tocqueville then has another crisis of conscience and thinks, well, what the hell's wrong with France? You know, where have we gone wrong? And he writes another famous book called The Ancien Regime of the, Ancien Regime of the French Revolution, where he wrestles with the problem of why France has in fact managed to rock between either violent revolution or democratic despotism. Whatever happened, what are the conditions that have made this impossible to produce in France? And that's another of his great books, which came out in 1856, which has been studied maybe more in Britain than in, there has been, for example, a set text for history students at the University of Oxford for decades and decades.
And Robert, it's very interesting when you go back to even that election in France in 1848, you get an insight into his personality, the way he walked with the farmers to the polling booth, and they walked in alphabetical order rather than him at the head.
Yes, I mean, there was a sense in which he pretended that they were all equal, but at the same time, you know, there was no doubt that they would elect him as the local seigneur, as their politicians. He did still have that aristocratic sense that although everyone had to vote, nevertheless, people like himself, the educated and the propertied, should have a sort of say. But I think within weeks, the assembly was being invaded by the mob from Paris, and then within a few more weeks, there was rioting and bloodshed on the streets of Paris. And so, again, democracy, you know, turned sour for him in many ways.
Albert, what were his thoughts on legal systems, and in particular the jury system?
I think they can be understood by putting him into the context of his overarching question of how a democratic form of government can maintain itself, remain stable, function effectively rather than descend into turbulence. And American democracy appeared to be working better than elite opinion in Europe would have predicted. So there was this puzzle, you know, how so? And there was a logic he started to see in which American institutions and American social action and organization outside institutions encouraged the exercise of popular power, but modulated it, channeled it in constructive ways. And so I think, you know, these general ideas are helpful in understanding how he approaches the legal system. He was impressed, I think, by the strong role of the judiciary in government, in society, the power of judicial review, for example, serving as a counterweight to executive and legislative power, the social esteem people seem to have for judges outside the courtroom. And this, again, is sort of a puzzle. You know, why would this be happening in a place where equality of conditions was also so strong? And the judiciary has a symbolic role as protector of the Constitution. But that role is made secure by a kind of political sociology that connects judges, connects court professionals to lay citizens through the jury. So it was the jury system and the legal system were part of this larger, you know, sort of political sociology that he talks about in Democracy in America.
Very good. Andreas, it is an interesting dimension to the work.
Yes, but the hardware, let's not forget the hardware, like the institutions, the legal system, so on, it's all necessary. But it wouldn't work if without the habits of the heart. This is one of the crucial terms that Tocqueville uses in Democracy in America, the deliberation aspects of democracy. It's not just about throwing a paper into a ballot box every once in a while. There are things happening in between, and he looked at this in detail and looked at town hall meetings in New England, and that was a very important part, an ingredient to his idea of how democracy could work.
Kevin, your book deals with that in detail, the sense that Americans were forever forming associations, in Tocqueville's words, that he was very interested in that idea of America as a nation of joiners.
That's right. And it stood out for him in an overwhelmingly positive way. Americans actually were much more ambivalent about that phenomenon of this explosion of associations for every conceivable purpose, from accomplishing something grand to the tiniest little reading club or debating society or music society. But Tocqueville saw in it something that could counteract the isolation that is a product of democracy and democracy in that classic sense of the sort of equality of the masses, which can be extraordinarily isolating. People no longer have a place where they fit into the hierarchy of a society. They're isolated and atomized individuals. And things to counteract that, the juries, the political institutions, these private associations, all those things bring people together and cultivate those habits of the heart, those attitudes and ways of life that are so essential to a democracy. And Tocqueville saw it, and when Americans read Tocqueville on themselves, they began to think too of their civil society, of their vibrant associationalism, as a positive thing, something that they could think very, very highly of, something that was important to the American democracy.
Robert, it's very interesting when we look then at these contributions that he made to our understanding of democracy, equality, liberty, and so on. Is that his great legacy, that he is this prophet of democracy and that he was putting into words concepts that were going to become dominant in the world in the years ahead?
Well, yes, he was a prophet of democracy, but as I think a lot of the discussion has shown, he was quite sceptical and wary of things that could go wrong. And as various people have said, I mean, he was a great believer in debate and parliamentary debate and the importance of parliamentary debate, not just the ballot box. And I think if he came back today, for example, if he came to Britain today, he would be rather depressed by the level of parliamentary debate around Brexit, and his notions about the tyranny of the majority would be sort of borne out by the fact that since the vote 3 years ago, people have said, well, you know, 17.4 million people have voted. It was only a narrow majority, but you know, we're not interested in hearing from the people who didn't vote with that majority. So I think he would be a bit depressed by the level of debate and a lot of parliamentary boxes. He'd be certainly concerned about the rise of populist leaders. But I think he would be a very salutary person to interview on your program about where he thought things were going at the moment.
It would be very interesting to have him on about that. Andreas, a final question. You wrote an excellent piece in the Dublin Review of Books, which had a heading, Democracy Sphinx. What does that mean?
Well, it refers to the problem of getting the balance right between equality and liberty. And Tocqueville is all about that. It's about that balance. So it's not about what populists keep telling us, namely that they represent 100% of the population. Nobody ever does that. So it's important to respect minorities and defend the liberty of individuals. It's a very important part of modern democracy.
Okay, well, I think they are two very profound notes on which to end the show tonight. So my thanks to my wonderful panel of experts, Professor Robert Gilday, Professor Andreas Hess, Dr. Chris W. Sir Pranant, Dr. Kevin Butterfield, Professor Harvey Mansfield, Professor Jeremy Jennings, and Professor Albert Zazur. That is it for us for another week. My thanks to my wonderful producer, Susan Cattle, to David Nolan on sound. Next week, we'll bring you the story of perhaps Ireland's greatest ever adventurer, Buck Whaley, as well as an exciting new exhibition and also the history of Irish publishing in our monthly book show. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.